Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to Angry Planet. I'm Jason Fields.
And I'm Matthew Galt.
Nobody outside the Kremlin, and maybe inside the Kremlin too, knows exactly what happened over the last weekend. We do know that Yevgeny Prigozhin led something that looked like a rebellion against Vladimir Putin's government. Columns of troops and tanks turned toward the motherland, and elements of the Wagner group made it inside 200 miles of Moscow. What did Prigozhin really want, though? And what happened to end the crisis? And is the crisis actually really over? Joining us today is Mark Katz of George Mason University. He's a longtime Russia watcher and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, in addition to his teaching duties. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Can we start with just the absolute basics? Like, what's your view of what happened last weekend?
Well, it is complicated. Putin had promoted this fellow Prigozhin as sort of an alternative to his state security services. Prigozhin, you know, built up the Wagner group. They were able to operate sort of deniably, although everyone knew they were acting on behalf of Russia, whether in the Middle East or North Africa or elsewhere in Africa. And then, of course, with the war in Ukraine, Wagner fighters were recruited to fight against Ukraine. And Prigozhin went back to his old stomping grounds, the Russian prison system, to recruit there. And, you know, he appears to have been very effective, but at, you know, tremendous cost in terms of lives lost. And, you know, Putin basically, he likes to promote rivals. In other words, what he wants, he needs security services to keep the population in check, but he has to make sure that the security services aren't united and can overthrow him. And so he promotes rivalries among them. And you know, Wagner essentially was a group that was, you know, created. It wasn't a state organization at all. And I think that you know, there has been this rivalry between Prigozhin and the defense minister and chief of the general staff. You know, Prigozhin's been, you know, criticizing them heavily. They supposedly held back on weapon supplies, ammunition supplies for Prigozhin. And what I believe that Prigozhin was doing was that he didn't intend to overthrow Putin at all, that what he wanted to do was to help Putin come to his senses and rid him of these bad advisors, Shoigu and Gerasimov, and that then, you know, he and Putin together, that they would take care of things. But I also, you know, when Prigozhin came out and basically criticized the whole rationale for the war, that he said, you know, Ukraine was not a threat to Russia. It didn't need to be there. It was just these greedy generals who wanted to go to war. Maybe he thought that you know, Putin can use this as an excuse. Yeah, now I see the light thanks to you. But of course, Putin himself is intimately associated with the war. In other words, I think for Putin, this really is the, you know, central cause of his being. He believes everything he said about Ukraine being a threat and, you know, needing to be denazified, etc. And therefore, I think that in that Prigozhin, in his own mind, wasn't there to overthrow the government, then basically he was, you know, he had to stop.
It all felt like theater at the end of it, in a way. When he decided to turn around and, you know, he's talking to Lukashenko and, oh, I'm going to go to Belarus. The whole thing just felt very, I don't know if staged is the right word, but like a play, like a very elaborate play.
Right. I think it was, if it was a play, it was definitely ad lib. I don't think they had plan this in advance. And it is shocking that considering how Putin imprisons anyone who even slightly criticizes the war effort against Ukraine, to let someone who marched on Moscow seize Rostov, fired upon regular Russian military forces, to let this guy go off into exile in Belarus, apparently with his men as well, whoever wanted to go with him. This is shocking that Putin would allow this to happen. And I have a feeling that, it was one of these things where everyone was being a worst case analyst. In other words, maybe Prigozhin thought that other units of the armed forces would join him on his march to Moscow. They didn't. On the other hand, no one seemed to be stopping him. And so I think that for Putin, the idea was just, get this guy out of here now. If he's losing his nerve, this is the moment to defuse this. But that it really looks bad for Putin if this could happen. And I think that, part of the reason why Prigozhin didn't get as much support as he did is because he's leading Wagner against the regular military. Now I think the door is open for a regular military commander, unit commander. If they tried something like this, maybe they would get a lot more support. I don't know if that would happen. I don't think Putin knows either.
I heard a really interesting comparison to the Yeltsin Revolution, saying that in the early days of the that attempted coup, there was the largest sick out of police and security officials of all time, that they just nobody came to work just because they didn't want to pick a side at that point. Do you think there's something similar with the military, the way they sort of sat it out? Or
absolutely, yeah. I think that I think that the prudent thing was not to get involved, but that in retrospect, I think Putin and company are going to be going over this, who did what when, and that they're going to be drawing lessons as to who can be considered reliable or not, and maybe these people need to be gotten rid of. I think the problem for Putin is that. Can he trust anyone at all now to replace them? I think that, Putin, who tends to be paranoid anyway, that he really must be very nervous right now.
Is there, sorry,
go ahead.
I was just going to say, is there anyone who comes to mind for you at the moment that is a potential rival? There was a lot of, I would say, junk about how Prigozhin was himself a rival to Putin in the weeks leading up to this rebellion, if you want to call it that. Is there somebody?
It's really impossible to tell, because the moment that anyone seems like a possibility, Putin will move against that person. I think that if and when this happens, it will be a surprise move. It will be someone who has hitherto been a Putin loyalist. It'll just be a total surprise. As anyone who's expressing any sort of degree of independence now is probably not going to be able to operate in this manner.
How long do you think Prigozhin lives after this? What do you think is going to happen to him in Belarus? I just can't imagine that you let this stand.
Yeah, I would think, and certainly, Lukashenko has, claimed that, Putin has talked about killing him. I would think that for Putin, in that he has a history of, killing off some of his adversaries, some of his opponents, that I would think that Prigozhin would be very inconvenient, that I would not be surprised if there's an assassination attempt, certainly or a successful assassination of Prigozhin at some point within, the next few months. It'll be made to, or try to be made to look like some sort of accident. A lot of Putin's opponents seem to fall out of windows somehow or other. It's really quite interesting. Maybe a poisoning, but they'll try to, I think that I would not be surprised if something like this happens.
So I was sort of thinking it's interesting that Prigozhin knows this, may have even participated in previous defenestrations. Who knows? Was he in such a bad situation that he just had to take this risk? I mean, what? Why?
Yeah, well, I think that's one of the unknowable things. In other words, I think he could have kept on going toward Moscow. He may have succeeded. He may have even come to power for all that. But I really believe that Prigozhin, in his own mind, was not rebelling against Putin. That he was trying to help Putin by getting rid of the defense ministry people. And when it became clear that Putin wasn't going to go along with this narrative, then he got scared and, as usual, decided that protecting himself was the highest priority. I'm just shocked that this deal was arranged at all. But there we are.
Well, there was what? Pardon me, sorry. 30,000 men is our best guess. 30,000 soldiers?
Something like that. It appears to be something like that. So the issue that apparently inflamed Prigozhin was the requirement that Wagner forces sign this contract, subordinating themselves to the defense ministry. Now, Prigozhin obviously did not want to do that. That would vitiate his own authority. But I would have thought for a lot of individual Wagner fighters, maybe it wouldn't have been such a terrible thing. In other words, you fight for Wagner, your chance of becoming a casualty is much higher than if you're with the regular forces. So maybe if you sign this contract with the regular forces, maybe you won't. You'll be in a lesser degree of danger. At least that's, I think, a possibility. That we can't assume that all Wagner fighters are necessarily going to support Prigozhin. And maybe this is a way out. On the other hand, if your option is, move to sunny Belarus and not fight at all, then I can understand why a lot of guys might want to go over with him. That why be on the battlefield when there's this once in a lifetime opportunity to get out of it altogether?
How independent is Lukashenko? Did he volunteer to step in? Was he told to broker this deal? What do you think his real role might have been?
Certainly the portrayal of Lukashenko is that he is subordinate to Putin. But the thing is that I think he actually exercises a lot of autonomy, he can do a lot on his own. And I think that he saw this as an opportunity. Certainly, he himself says, he spoke first to Putin, then to Prigozhin. Both of them were willing to work with him, and that gave him the opportunity to do so. He's already talking about how, look, Wagner guys will be useful in training Belarusian forces. He also seems to indicate that Wagner will be there at his own expense. In other words, that Belarus might be making some money off of this. Maybe he has. It's not clear at all whether Prigozhin is still going to be able to control Wagner forces in the Middle East and Africa. And they're there making money through providing protection. Maybe Lukashenko wants a portion of that. And maybe it's even a degree of protection. In other words, that having Wagner guys in Belarus means that, if Putin decides to play rough with Belarus, it won't just be Belarusian forces that we have all, no combat experience. But it'll be Wagner forces he might have to come up against. So I think for Lukashenko, this isn't a bad outcome at all.
Does it change his role in the world?
Well, I think it does. I think that I think what this Ukraine war in general has done has made Russia a little bit. Brought it down to the level of some of its smaller partners. In other words, just like Putin is now dependent on Iran for arms supplies, dependent on North Korea, that they're now in a position to ask more of Russia than they might have otherwise. I think similarly with Lukashenko. He's done a big favor for Putin. Done what Putin has wanted. Now I think that there'll be payback. One issue I think that people haven't focused on is that supposedly these Russian tactical nuclear weapons have been deployed to Belarus. Question I have is, who ultimately controls these? Now, presumably they're coming, they come with their Russian minders, but obviously there aren't going to be very many of these. Can Lukashenko basically seize control of these tactical nuclear weapons at some point or under certain circumstances? In other words, that I don't know why Putin went to the trouble to deploy tactical nuclear weapons to Belarus. It would be just for the theater of it, that somehow this would get the West's attention. But I think that this is something else that also gives Lukashenko more autonomy, especially autonomy via Russia.
Yeah, we'll see how big it is, but you have a mercenary army that almost got to Moscow in a country with some tactical nukes deployed and a friendly government right there on that border with Ukraine, right? So it shuffles things in a very surreal and unpleasant way, I think.
And I think already we're seeing that there are some Western observers who are indicating that, now we really kind of need to work with Lukashenko. In other words, that he's more of an independent factor. It's one way to look at it is that he's more of a danger. Certainly the Baltic states are seeing it that way, Lithuania in particular. But I think there are others who are going to think that maybe there's a chance to, even if we can distance him from Putin to some extent, that's good enough to try for. And I'm sure Lukashenko will have every incentive to try to make everyone, whether it's Putin, whether it's Western governments, whether it's the Chinese government, think that it's in their interest to work with Lukashenko more than anything else.
How do you think Russia losing a portion of Wagner affects its war in Ukraine?
It sure doesn't help. Now, there's been different estimates as to exactly how many Wagner forces were fighting in Ukraine. I think there were estimates like up to 30,000, even 50,000. There are some who say, well, really effectively it was like 8,000. Whatever it is, if these guys aren't going to be joining the Russian military, that means that there are fewer people for Moscow to rely on. And the danger is that, if the Wagner fighters can, put up a fuss and leave the battlefield and go to Belarus, well, why not regular soldiers? Can they do the same thing as well? So I think that Wagner leaving the battlefield, where it was undertaking, a big mission, no longer doing this, it puts pressure, more pressure on the Russian military. And the question is, just how long will these individual ordinary soldiers, are they going to go along with this, especially now that they've seen it in an example of successful defection?
Yeah, nobody, as far as we know, on the Wagner side, there were very few casualties or almost none. And they all got to, they took two major Russian cities, right? They took Rostov and another one, and then they got to leave with seemingly no repercussions, except that you have to live in Belarus.
Which is not at war.
Which is not at war.
You don't have to fight anymore. So I would think that, I wouldn't be surprised if there are some generals who feel, well, maybe I'd have a better chance than Prigozhin. And if one has the possibility of also, if you don't work, but you can still escape, well, then the cost benefits of rebelling definitely are more in favor of rebelling. I'm not saying that, it's likely or that Putin would treat others in the same way. But I do think that this episode has opened the door to someone in the security services, and it'll have to be someone in the security services who basically agrees with Prigozhin's argument. we don't need to be in Ukraine. It's not really a threat to us, but continuing this war is a threat both to Russia and to the Russian armed forces. In other words, that the longer this goes on, the more men are chewed up in the meat grinder, that this is ultimately going to hurt the Russian army more than anything else, and we need to put a stop to it.
There's an interesting quote that I saw. Actually, it was Mark Galliotti who was talking about, if you know Mark at all, he's been on the show a bunch. He was talking about Putin and some of the other players as not exactly being capable of three-dimensional chess, right? That they are not responding in necessarily the most intelligent way. They're not necessarily thinking with a lot of forethought. I wonder how you see that. And is Putin, it's one thing to take on small countries like,
Chechnya.
It's one thing to take on small countries like Chechnya. It's another thing to take on Ukraine. And it's another thing to send away your nuclear weapons to Belarus.
Where do you think that was a tactical deployment?
Yeah, yeah, right. Tactical deployment of his own demise. Anyway, what do you think about, Putin's capabilities and what we've learned?
Well, I think just the whole invasion of Ukraine showed real stupidity. He really thought that he'd be welcomed by all right-thinking Ukrainians, because, of course, they're really Russians, and they know it. And this didn't happen. And then, of course, he continued on with the conflict. So, yeah, I think that up until then, he had been pretty careful. He chose conflicts either that he could win quickly or that he had help. You could, outsource the Chechen conflict to Kadyrov and his guys in Syria. It was the Iranians and their Hezbollah allies that are, carrying a lot of the burden of defending Assad. Georgia was just so little. And of course, his success in Crimea was just so, over and done. And I think that he had the idea that, it would be just as easy as lightning strike before anyone could respond. And then people would just have to deal just like they had before. And that didn't work. And partly didn't work because he had been successful in the past, that people had, had prepared. In other words, if he hadn't in 2014 stopped at the Crimea and eastern Ukraine, he'd just tried to keep on going. Maybe he would have succeeded. But because he was successful then, in other words, the Ukrainians and even the West to a certain degree were preparing for something to occur again. And he had a real fight on his hands, and he's not been able to conclude it successfully.
That makes me just wonder, the next question for me is, why does history repeat itself?
Well, I think this guy's in a bubble. And he has surrounded himself with people who tell him exactly what he wants to hear. And anyone who tells him different has long ago been excluded from this circle at best. So anything he thinks, he's in an echo chamber. And I think that it was divorced from reality. Very much, I think, like Saddam Hussein was in Kuwait. People who sort of knew about that system indicated the same thing. In other words, he was just so convinced of his own strength and his adversary's weakness that he operated on that basis. I think similar with Putin, he did the same thing, and he ultimately is hoping that the West will be divided and will crack, will back down. Maybe Trump will come back into office. Of course, he's assuming that even if that happens, that Trump could actually change the policy. He just basically, he listens to what he wants to hear. And now I think it's getting harder, though. In other words, that he's not just facing war with Ukraine. he's facing, you know, can he trust his own security services at home? That's a far more important problem. And I think one that's not going to be going away.
I think one of my biggest takeaways from learning about European history, looking at hundreds of years, is that if you exile someone at the head of a mercenary army instead of killing them, you're going to have to fight them again later. Like, it always comes back up every single time.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, one of the really shocking things was those images of Prigozhin and Rostov, and people were cheering him. People, you know, were liking him. That, I think, is a real threat. Something maybe that Prigozhin himself hadn't really anticipated, that ordinary Russians would see him as somehow being heroic. And this has got to, this might give him ambition, which I think is going to make it necessary for Putin to get rid of him sooner rather than later. Because, yeah, if he's allowed to thrive, who knows? And remember, Lukashenko himself, you know, when this union treaty was signed in the 1990s, his idea was that, well, you know, Russia, Belarus are in this union. Yeltsin's so unpopular that Lukashenko would be the guy taking over. He was disabused of that under Putin. Who knows? Maybe this guy, Lukashenko, sees this as ultimately the gambit. In other words, that there'll be a lot of people in Russia who, absent any other candidate, maybe Lukashenko could be the, you know, the saint who comes in from the West and can run everything. And that, you know, these guys, I think, have outsized egos. So I would not be surprised if Lukashenko and Prigozhin together, you know, think of something like this.
But it's funny, the idea of cheering Prigozhin. I mean, of all the people to cheer, I mean, this is not a particularly nice guy. He's not likely to restore freedom to Russia or democracy. I mean, does that just show how much people are tired of Putin? I mean, that, well, anybody looks good?
I think that part of it was that, you know, who did Prigozhin rely on as his fighters? Prisoners. In other words, not conscripts, not draftees, not my boy, not, you know, it was, you know, these people who are no good anyway. So I think that was something that a lot of Russians were happy about. Yeah, Prigozhin and the prisoners want to fight. That means we don't have to fight. And that's the thing that I think that is Putin's real weakness, is that, you know, with everyone who fled at the sign of the, you know, conscription last year, that there really isn't deep-seated support for this war. Not that they necessarily oppose it, but they don't want to make any sacrifices for it, that's for sure. And I think that Prigozhin offered people an alternative. Yeah, here's a guy who will carry on the fight, but not at our expense. And that, of course, with Prigozhin gone, you know, is that option still there? Now, of course, the defense ministry is now supposedly recruiting within prisons. But I think what the real fear is that, well, if there are not enough of Wagner volunteers, are they going to start conscripting people in Russia at some point? And that, I think, will be a very dangerous moment.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Can we zoom out and talk about what it was like to do your job on Friday as all of this is playing out. Did you have a sense that you were watching a historical moment akin to like 1991? What were your feelings at the time?
You know, it very much reminded me of the late Gorbachev years when anything you wrote today, because, you know, just became outdated tomorrow. And that the sense of possibilities are now far more open. You know, I had been studying the Soviet Union for the longest time, and not that much really changed. In other words, you had, yes, some leaders changed, whatever, but that, you know, whether it's their foreign policy, domestic policies, everything changed, or everything stayed the same. And then, you know, when Gorbachev came in and said he was going to change things, well, every previous leader had said that too. So it was very hard to believe. Then suddenly things did start to change, and change an awful lot. Late Gorbachev, early Yeltsin. But then they kind of went back to sort of the old predictable ways. And certainly under Putin, that was the case. Now, you know, Putin is not announcing any kind of change, that's for sure. But the fact that this happened, yeah, what it shows is that just as in the late Cold War period, Russia is not as stable a place as it once was, and that anything can happen, that a new leadership could come to power, which could very well see its interests change. You know, it doesn't seem like there's going to be a democratic revolution. Putin seems to have inoculated Russia against that with these security services. But, of course, in other democratic revolutions, it's security service defection is one of the key elements that is occurring. That is a possibility. But even another authoritarian leader could just decide to reverse course. In other words, the war in Ukraine is hurting Russia. Let's put an end to this and blame it all on Putin. That would be popular, probably. That would be a popular position. I think there's a lot of Western countries who would be very happy to work with such an authoritarian Russian leader, a reasonable authoritarian, you know, authoritarian modernizer, practical, pragmatic. We definitely work with such an actor, might even pressure Ukraine to make some concessions, you know, for the greater good. I think that there are now possibilities that we just haven't seen until recently. And, maybe they'll come to fruition, but maybe not.
No, but that's actually seems like such a good point, because there are parts of NATO that really are not happy with what's, you know, the stance towards Russia. I mean, they're on board, but they're sort of barely on board. You have Hungary. You have the election in Slovakia, which I think happened over the weekend as well. I'm just saying it makes sense. I mean, the alliance is sort of barely holding on as is.
I think German public opinion, in other words, they benefited from American protection, exporting to China, and cheap Russian gas. And they'd like to get back to that. In other words, if they could get back to having a reasonable Russia, that would be just fine with them and probably a lot of other European countries as well. I think that, that would actually be very much in Russia's interest to see Putin replaced with someone who is a little more subtle in terms of just behaving reassuringly, that people would fall all over themselves. But we have to do something to, we don't want to go back to Putin. We have to, or someone like him. So we have to make concessions to Russia. I think that would be the natural reaction. I can even think of the people who would make such an argument. But not to say so here.
What do you think the next signs would be of a change? Is there anything that people should be looking for?
Well, I think that part of it's going to be is that how do they shore up the Ukrainian front? In other words, where are the guys who are going to replace Wagner fighters going to come from? Maybe it's the Wagner fighters themselves who signed this contract. although again, I think, you know, I prefer to go to Belarus myself, but that they're going to have to do more to get people in the military. And I think this is not something that's going to be popular. Also, I think that Putin may be tempted to replace a lot of the military leadership, because I think, you know, the post-mortem on this, what he's going to go through, it's like, okay, yeah, no one came out and sided with Prigozhin, but who did nothing? Who just stood aside? Those are people that Putin cannot trust. You know, you leave them in office, I mean, that's almost as bad as letting Prigozhin go. It's worse because they're there in Russia. On the other hand, who do you replace them with? Is there anyone really more loyal? In other words, can he trust anyone? And so what I would foresee is sort of more intensive purges and shuffling in the security service leadership, Putin going back to his own, his instincts is to play them off against each other, you know, to make sure that they can't cooperate with each other. But I think that this is, you know, when you're fighting a war, then this means, okay, you want to keep your security services weak for your own internal purposes, but they need to be strong to fight a foreign enemy. You can't do it both ways. Either you build them up to fight the foreigners effectively, but then that risks them being strong enough to hurt you internally, or you keep them divided internally, and then that undermines their ability to fight the external enemy. So I think this is a trap he of his own making, which he cannot get out of.
You make it sound like it's almost now we're just waiting for the rest of the dominoes to fall. Like, this is probably the end of Putin. It may take a year. It may take 2 years. When it happens, it will be shockingly fast, possibly. But you make it sound like this is maybe it.
Well, I mean, obviously, there's probably a degree of wishful thinking in all this. This is what, you know, I mean, it's not just that I think this will happen. It's what I want to happen. And that, of course, is always dangerous in terms of analyzing anything. You know, it might not. But obviously, at some point, Putin does have to go. What, he's 70 now, which is actually, now that I'm almost 70, it doesn't seem so old. But he can't stay in that position forever. And, you know, what does he do? Does he wait to be overthrown? Or does he decide to do a Prigozhin? Maybe not move to Belarus. That would really be interesting. Maybe to Beijing, or maybe to Pyongyang. God.
He may be one of the world's richest men, right? I mean, there is some thought that he really is.
You have to be able to access this wealth.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is problematic. And wherever you move, you know, your hosts are going to demand a good portion of it. That's for sure. Not going to be safe. So, you know, I think that, you know, here's a guy who's also worried about self-preservation. Now, he has such an enormous ego. He, you know, sees his own survival and Russia's survival as basically one and the same. But if he comes to the understanding that he really can't trust anyone, I presume that, like Prigozhin, he will want to save himself above anything else. He may have already been, you know, working on this. And there might be some places that would be willing to take him. You know, just like Lukashenko took Prigozhin. Might, you know, they might find him useful. So, or, you know, well, supposedly he watches the tape of Gaddafi being killed by the mob, you know, over and over again. If that's really what he is afraid of, then I would think flight would occur to him as a way to escape from this. Now, you know, is it that bad? Has he gotten to this point? I don't know. But I think that here's a guy who thinks in worst case terms, that he has to anticipate that maybe, you know, if he can't trust his own security people, then maybe he needs to make other arrangements.
It's so hard to picture for me, you know.
It is. And I imagine, picture yourself in his shoes. You can't be happy. He can't be happy with the situation he is now in. He really, you know, nothing's happening that to make him feel better, it seems to me.
These kinds of stories always end one way, though, right? Like, very rarely do you get to be Stalin and have everyone so cowed that you die in bed and everyone's afraid to roll you over. If
that's what actually happened. It was the doctor's plot right there at the end. Maybe the doctors got him, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, like Nicholas I, whom I think is the real model for Putin. He comes in, he's very successful with his wars, suppressing any domestic opposition. Then he gets himself involved in the Crimean War, and he bites off more than he can chew as he, he's at war with the Ottoman Empire, which he'd been able to deal with successfully before. And suddenly he's also at war with Britain and France and others, and it all goes. But he does not stop the war. In other words, he has to basically die in office. Then his successor, Alexander II, extracts Russia from this. And that, I think, is a possibility. In other words, that this Putin will keep on doing what he's doing so long as he's alive. And so the only way to end this war will be to subtract Putin in whatever way. And whether it's to overthrow him, whether he simply dies in bed, or whether he flees. And if I were Putin, I think I'd know which option I would ultimately prefer. Or in other words, if dying in bed doesn't appear to be, there's sort of at some point in the future, in the distant future, doesn't seem like it's going to be an option, then maybe fleeing might be.
Well, I mean, the Kremlin has a lot of windows.
It does. Yeah, it really does. And I think that, I think this episode more than anything else has let Putin understand that he cannot completely trust his own security services, and that there's no one else. He could act to save the leader of Kazakhstan. He could act to help Lukashenko, but there's no one who could help him. And I don't think the Chinese are going to be sending troops to Moscow to protect Putin. So he's on his own. The real worry is that basically he decides to unleash Armageddon. Certainly, I understand that he once said, and what's interesting, in the past, a lot of my Russian students have said, without Russia, the world need not continue. That there is this idea that if Russia isn't going to be successful, well, then there's just no reason for the world to even exist. Would he unleash some kind of Armageddon? Now, the trouble, of course, is doing this is that, you don't survive yourself, that's for sure. And you also have to then, the people you give the order to actually obey, just as you were talking about earlier. People didn't obey the orders to move against Yeltsin back in 1991. Can he be sure that such an order is a terrible thing? In other words, that if you obey it, you're probably going to be dead within, an hour because of what you've unleashed. So why do it? So even if he wants to, let everyone die strategy, it's not clear that he can rely on his own people to unleash this.
I'd just say this is the perfect note. Unless Matthew, you have something else. We like to go out on a downer.
We like to go out on a downer. So talking about nuclear war, the destruction of all life on the planet.
Oh, right. Well, that's the guy's after my own heart. That's right. Yeah. I believe in the power of pessimism.
It doesn't tend to lead you astray.
Right. Yeah. That's the one optimistic thing about being a pessimist is that you're rarely disappointed.
And you're usually prepared.
That's right. There you go.
Well, Mark Katz, thank you so much for joining us today and taking us through what we know. Is it complex.
It is indeed. All right. Well, that's great being with you guys, and really appreciate your inviting me onto the show.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Angry Panda. The show is produced with love by Matthew Galt and Jason Fields, with the assistance of Kevin O'Dell. This is the place where we ask you for money. If you subscribe to us on substack.angryplanet.com, it means the world to us. The show, which we've been doing for more than 7 years now, means the world to us, and we hope it means a lot to you. We're incredibly grateful to our subscribers. Please feel free to ask us questions, suggest show ideas, or just say hi. $9 a month may sound like a big ask, but it helps us to do the show on top of everything else that we do. We'd love to make Angry Planet a full-time gig and bring you a lot more content. If we get enough subscriptions, that's exactly what we'll do. But even if you don't subscribe, we're grateful that you listen. Many of you have been listening since the beginning, and seriously, that makes it worth doing the show. Thank you for listening, and look for another episode next week. Stay safe.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.